Hey, it's Cole Swindell. After I give everything I've got to land a perfect vocal, I usually take five before jumping into the next track. And I've learned exactly how to recharge in that time. Some folks grab coffee. I hit a quick good luck spin. Next thing you know, the break is just as fun as laying down the track. A better break makes for a better take. Need a break? Let's chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus TNC supply. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome back to Epochs, where it's the big 200, the 200th episode, and how appropriate it is, how apt, how fitting and right, how apropos that I should be talking about one of the greatest stories that the English monarchy ever created. The story that is the story of Henry V, the dread sovereign, good King Hal. I almost feel like I'm not worthy, as many have done before me, including Shakespeare himself. Thought that the story was so great that it would be difficult to tell. Well, I shall endeavour nonetheless. So one of the first things to say about Henry V is that his story is so bound up with Shakespeare's play, Henry V. And he also appears in the earlier plays of Henry IV with Falstaff and all that sort of thing. But in the play, Henry V, it's so sort of famous, especially to sort of the English or British mind, that it's difficult to separate fact from fiction. Of course, here in my story, as your friendly neighbourhood history bro, as your humble narrator, I shall be talking about the real history, of course. But here or there, I might actually quote from The Bard. In fact, I'll start by quoting from the opening of the play, Henry V, and it gives you a sense of that feeling for sort of how great the story is. So the chorus, the narrator for Shakespeare's play, opens by saying this: "Oh, for a muse of fire that would ascend the greatest heaven of invention," i.e., I'm going to tell your story, but you're going to need to use your imagination. "A kingdom for a stage, princes to act, and monarchs to behold the swelling scene," i.e., we almost need actual kings to play the parts in this play. That's how great it is. "Then should warlike Harry," that's King Henry V, "warlike Harry, like himself, assume the port of Mars, the god of war. He has become the god of war. And at his heels, leashed in like hounds, should famine, sword, and fire crouch for employment. But pardon, gentles all, the flat unraised spirit that hath dared on this unworthy scaffold, we're not worthy, to bring forth so great an object. Can this cockpit hold the vasty fields of France? Or may we cram within this wooden O," the Globe Theatre on the South Bank in London, "the very casks that did affright the heir of Agincourt? Oh, pardon, since a crooked figure may attest in little place a million, and let us, ciphers of this great account, on your imaginary forces work." Again, you have to use your imagination quite often. "Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high uprearred and abutted fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. Piece out our interfections with your thoughts. Within a thousand parts divide one man, and make imaginary prurescence. Think, when we talk of horses, that you see their printing their proud hoofs in the receiving earth. For it is your thoughts that now must deck out kings, carry them here and there, jumping over times, turning the accomplishments of many years into an hourglass. For the which supply, admit me chorus to this history, who, prologue-like, your humble patience, pray gentle to hear, kindly to judge, our play." End quote. Okay, before I get stuck into the early life of Henry, this will have to be more than one episode, of course, just to mention some of the sources, because we actually know quite a bit about the life and times of Henry V. He's sort of, it's fair to say, truly in the light of history. For earlier kings, for William the Conqueror, for example, we know relatively little. There's the pinprick of light shines upon his age, and we get small scenes here and there, and the rest is all darkness. But by the early 15th century, we have a fair bit. It's not quite in the full light of history, I'd say. It's not like the 17th century, where we've got lots of letters and journals and accounts from both sides all over the place. An embarrassment of riches. It's not quite that, but we do have a fair bit. For example, the rolls, the royal rolls, all the accounting. We know how a lot of money was spent, you know, down to the penny or fraction of a penny often. And you can reconstruct or infer loads from that. But we also have a number of histories. There are two histories written in the 1430s. One is the Vita et Gesta Henrici Quinti, the life and deeds of Henry V, often known as the Pseudo Elmham, because it was thought it might have been written by Thomas Elmham, a monk of St. Augustine's Abbey in Canterbury, that appears to draw on information from the Lord Walter Hungerford, who was actually around at the time. So a good source, really. The other one is the Vita Henrici Quinti, the life of Henry V, which draws upon Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, who was one of Henry's younger brothers. There's also the first English life of King Henry V, written a bit later in the very, very early 16th century. There's the Tudor chronicler, Edward Hall, who wrote The Union of the Two Illustrious Families of Lancaster and York. And then there's Holinshed's Chronicles, which is a collaborative work. And that seems, scholars have decided that Shakespeare probably drew heavily from Holinshed. And then there are other bits and bobs here and there, some French accounts and things. But it is a truly great story. Most historians, until very recently, thought of Henry V as possibly our greatest king. In terms of martial prowess, he's certainly one of the greatest, up there with Edward I or Edward III. Even K.B. McFarlane, a very eminent historian, who was not known for his breathless admiration of monarchs, said that all round, Henry V was, I think, the greatest man that ever ruled England. So let's just jump straight in then to the earliest portions of Henry's life. I shall have to go back over some of the ground I did in the last episode. There was a reason why the episode I did on Henry IV was pretty much an overview, because a lot of it, most of it, the last years of it, I'm going to go over again in a lot more detail here, but from the perspective of the young Henry. So let's try and get into his head. Let's try and find out what kind of person he was, or what his formative years were like, the world in which he was born and grew up in. So the first thing to say is that he is a member of the royal family, a senior member, but definitely not, absolutely not, in the line of succession. He was never meant to be king. There were many people ahead of him. So, you know, how does that happen? How did that come about that he does, in fact, become king? So everyone knows what it's like when you're a child and you realise your sort of position in the world, when you realise your social standing. I mean, I, for myself, you know, when I was under 10, realised that I was born into a poor working class family. We weren't exactly dirt poor, never went hungry or shoeless, but had no money and certainly didn't own any land, no titles, not even close, but had sort of literary pretensions, and me and my siblings were expected to go to university and then we'd have to work really hard for the rest of our lives to make ends meet. That's my lot in life. That was the hand I was dealt at birth. So for Henry V, you would have been told as a small child that your great-grandfather, who's now dead, used to be the king, a great king, Edward III, who ruled for a very long time and was hugely successful. The most successful king in a long time, had smashed the French up many times in France. And so this great shining king was your grandfather, great-grandfather. And now your uncle is the king, that is Richard II. And your father is his cousin, they're about the same age. And your grandfather is John of Gaunt, who at the time was one of, arguably at certain points, the most powerful man in the country, more powerful than the king sometimes at various points. So you're a senior member of the royal family, very important, but nowhere near the throne itself. But your uncle is king and your father is the Duke of Lancaster, the Earl of Derby, one of the most important lords or earls or dukes in the whole country. And you're his eldest son. So you're absolutely right at the pinnacle of society, but not in line to the throne, expected to inherit great things. You will become, when you grow up, one of the richest and most important men in the country. Your uncle is king and your grandfather is super, super powerful, but sometimes out of favour. Your grandfather is walking a tightrope, a political tightrope, and your father himself has to sort of keep his head down and play the game and be a good boy. But the king himself has got all sorts of political troubles and even views many of his closest men, including your own father and grandfather, as enemies sometimes, certainly people to be wary of. Okay, so today I'm going to read from Anne Curry, historian Anne Curry, who I think does the best job of painting the picture of the early life, the childhood of Henry V. So I'll be reading from her. And her book is actually called Henry V, Playboy Prince to Warrior King. So before I actually start reading, just to mention again, there's this idea that Shakespeare plays up, which most historians think now isn't really all that accurate, that when Henry was young, or before he actually became king, he was something like a playboy, that he slept around, that he drank wildly, that he had very bawdy friends like John Falstaff, and that he was carefree and a bit of a tearaway. And but that once he became king, he put all those childish things aside and became super serious, super pious, and super warlike, a dread sovereign. Well, we now think that that's just not true. It's not really particularly accurate. He was always a very serious sort of person. Had no real choice. The maelstrom that he was thrown into meant that he had to grow up very, very quickly. I mean, by the time he's 12 or 13, he's kind of, well, he is involved in things. By the time he's 15 or 16, certainly involved in things. Okay, so Anne Curry says this, quote, according to an astrological treatise written during his own reign, Henry V, or as he was then known, the young Lord Henry, came into the world at 11:22 a.m. on the morning of the 16th of September 1386, born in a tower above the gatehouse of Monmouth Castle in the Welsh Marches. Later historians, misreading a financial record, gave him a fictitious, short-lived elder brother, but there is no doubt that he was in fact the firstborn of six to Henry Bolingbroke, Earl of Derby, who at that point can have little idea of the path that would lead him to ascend the English throne as King Henry IV, the first Lancastrian king, and his wife, Mary de Bohun, then some 16 or 17 years old. So one of the first things to say there, Henry had three other brothers. So there's these four boys. His younger brothers are Thomas, Duke of Clarence, John, the Duke of Bedford, and Humphrey, the Duke of Gloucester, each of which become important and play their role, some of them after Henry himself is dead. But okay, so remember, Clarence, Bedford, and Gloucester, they're his younger brothers. Usually it's a problem to have so many princes like that, that they would vie for power and undermine each other and even kill each other and things. In the Wars of the Roses, in the next generation, we'll see exactly that sort of thing play out. But here, although they don't always entirely get on and see eye to eye exactly, the three younger brothers do all look up to Henry ultimately and do as he asks, certainly by the time he actually becomes king. So bear that in mind. They don't turn on each other. So that's lucky. A bit like Hannibal and the Lion's Brood, all the brothers do work more or less essentially in unison. Okay, Curry goes on. Henry V's birthplace was owned by his grandfather, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, the third surviving son of King Edward III, and a major political force in the reign of Richard II. Monmouth was among the many lands and castles which had come to Gaunt thanks to his marriage to Blanche, heiress of the great earldom and subsequently duchy of Lancaster. As Gaunt's first grandson, Henry was the heir presumptive to this great duchy, the largest and most valuable land holding in England, other than that of the crown, with major holdings in Lancashire and the Midlands, but tentacles in East Anglia, South Wales, and the Welsh Marches or the Borderlands. An inheritance from his maternal ancestors could also be expected. Henry's mother was co-heiress with her sister, Eleanor, of their father, Humphrey de Bohun, Earl of Hereford and Essex, and the expectation was that their inheritance would be divided between their families. This prompted Richard II's granting of the title of Duke of Hereford to Bolingbroke, that's Al Henry's father, of course, another title his eldest son would expect to inherit. So, as I said, not just a senior member of the royal family, but arguably his line, the most powerful, richest ones, but not, definitely not in the direct line of succession. Ahead of young Lord Henry, then, was a path that would lead him to becoming one of England's highest ranking noblemen. As a member of a collateral line of the royal family, it was likely that at the age of majority, 21, when you're a child, it's said that you're in your minority. Once you become a man, legally, you're in your majority. So bear that in mind. So at the age of majority, 21, or at marriage, he would have been given a title and a landed endowment, even in advance of coming into his full inheritance of the Duchies of Lancaster and Hereford. As a peer of the realm, he would have been summoned to Parliament and involved in national and local politics and governance. He would have served in royal armies and embassies, and perhaps, following in his father's footsteps, participated in crusade. What we can glean of Henry's childhood from the financial records of his father and grandfather reveals an upbringing commensurate with his future prospects. The earliest known is the purchase of baby clothing, a demigown, for him at the age of one. So these are details we just don't get in centuries before this. Again, we're emerging into the full light of history here. As was customary, he spent the first 5 years of his life with his mother, but he also had a wet nurse, Joan Wirren, whom he remembered when he became king, giving her a generous annuity. Like all aristocratic families, Lord Henry and his relatives and servants moved frequently between their various houses and estates, During his early years, we find him with his maternal grandmother, Joan Fitzalan, Countess of Hereford, at her house at Bitham in Lincolnshire, as well as frequenting his paternal grandfather's castles at Leicester and Kenilworth, which came to be one of his favourite places. As king, he would return there often, even building a special retreat for himself in its grounds. 7 books of Latin grammar bound together were brought for him in London when he was 8 years old, around the age at which his formal education would have begun. Later evidence indicates that Henry had a good knowledge of Latin and was conversant in French. Indeed, he appears a relatively bookish king, although the story that he attended Queen's College, Oxford in 1398 is apocryphal. So again, the picture is of a serious, more of a serious boy rather than this runaway, tearaway, uncontrollable, libertine, drunkard, womaniser. The evidence isn't really there for that, to be perfectly honest. Other purchases of the 1390s reveal different aspects of a noble upbringing as he moved towards his teens. Swords, saddles and armour, a chain for his greyhounds, and the assigning of a group of several to his care and tutelage, which included Peter de Melbourne, a highly trusted life retainer of both Gaunt and his son. So once again, the details of the records go down to even the buying of a chain to chain up some greyhounds. Remarkable detail for, 600 plus years ago. In August 1396, shortly before his 10th birthday, the purchase of saddles with silver gilt fittings, quote, for the journey to Calais, quote, reveals that he had crossed the Dover Strait to attend the marriage of England's king, Richard II, to Isabella, 7-year-old daughter of King Charles VI of France, a union which was intended to cement a 30-year truce with France and facilitate the negotiation of a full peace. So, once again, remember, we're still in the middle of the Hundred Years' War, or not in the middle of it, but the Hundred Years' War is still going on, and the Hundred Years' War, note, is much longer than 100 years. So the glory days of Crecy and Poitiers are long ago, 50, 60 years ago, but the war is still going on and off, shall we say. During the negotiations, there had been mention of Henry marrying Isabella's younger sister, Michelle, then still only a 1-year-old. Another option being the daughter of the Duke of Brittany, also aged under 5. Even if not an active participant in such discussions, we can assume that Henry was already aware of the issues of Anglo-French relations, which were to loom so large in his adult life. A year later, he was exposed to national government, so very young, forced to grow up very, very quickly. Robes were provided for him and his eldest brother, Thomas, for the parliament at which their father was created Duke of Hereford on the 29th of September 1397. Whether or not Henry heard his father make in the parliament allegations of treason against Thomas Mowbray, Duke of Norfolk, in response to Mowbray's warning that the king intended to destroy both Bolingbroke and himself, or whether he was present in Coventry in October 1398 when the resulting duel between Bolingbroke and Mowbray was due to take place, is not known. But he undoubtedly felt the effect of Richard II's decision to abort the duel and send both men into exile. Mowbray for life, Henry's father for 10 years. Okay, so that's a massive thing in the young Henry's life. He's like 12 odd years old. He's about 12. And his father is completely disgraced and exiled for 10 years. But still, as mentioned in the last episode, Richard II actually takes all the estates that his father had, takes them for himself. So sort of, disinheriting the young Henry. Nominally just for 10 years, but everyone knows it would have probably been forever. Or it's at least an extremely sharp fall from grace that his grandfather, John of Gaunt, is in foreign lands and essentially keeping his head down. And now his father has been exiled. Mentioned the ill-fated duel there, where the king had decreed that Mowbray and Bolingbroke should duel, perhaps to the death. But at the last moment, Richard calls it off and says, no, you don't have to actually fight. We don't actually need a trial by combat. But you're both exiled, and Mowbray forever. So Henry goes from, our young Henry, goes from a possible shining future, sort of, you would have thought guaranteed, as long as he lives, to be one of the most important men in England, to suddenly now just the son of a disinherited and exiled sort of ex-noble. So terrible. But the young Henry, again, only about 12, himself isn't forced into exile with his father. In fact, Richard, the King Richard II, his uncle, keeps him close, keeps him in his own household. Many people have wondered what their relationship was actually like. I've said it, all this is in the full light of history. Well, not in the full light of history. There's no real accounts of exactly what their relationship was like or what they talked about or how Richard saw the young Henry, whether he was a type of hostage or whether he actually liked or even loved him. as a nephew, whether he kept him under his wing and thought of him as some sort of surrogate son, or whether he was just a hostage. We don't know. We're not really sure. There's lots of conjecture on that. Curry continues. Equally disruptive for the now 12-year-old Henry was the death 4 months later, on the 3rd or 4th of February, 1399, of his grandfather, John of Gaunt. Richard II decided that the exiled Bolingbroke should not be allowed to seek his inheritance of the Duchy of Lancaster until he had served the full term of his exile. This placed the boy in a potentially difficult position financially, since he could no longer be supported by his father or grandfather. That's that fall from grace I was talking about. Yet the king was keen not to disparage the young man. Within 3 weeks of his grandfather's death, Richard had granted him £500 per annum from royal revenues, although he seems not to have come to court, but remained in the care of Peter de Melbourne. In early May 1399, he was allocated further funds towards armour and equipment for the king's expedition to Ireland. So there was trouble in Ireland. The Irish were revolting, and the king decided he would go over there and sort the whole situation out with fire and sword. A real blunder in hindsight, strategically. So Henry was going on the king's expedition to Ireland, which Richard had decided he should accompany, and on which de Melbourne also served. According to Jean Creton, a French observer who later wrote an account of the Irish expedition and of Richard's disposition later in the year, the king dubbed Henry a knight during the campaign, just before an anticipated engagement with the Irish rebels. So once again, forced to grow up very quick. If you're created a knight, you're expected on some level to be acting as a man. I mean, we live in an infantilized world now, but in the pre-modern age and the ancient world, or lots of cultures even to this day, when you're about 14 or 15 or so, you're expected to start behaving like a man. So certainly our Henry here doesn't enjoy much of a childhood. The story goes on. The campaign was Henry's first experience of warfare. Even if we do not know whether he actually participated in action, it was common for noble boys to be taken on campaign once they were 12. But did Richard have an ulterior motive in taking Henry to Ireland, holding him as a hostage to ensure his father's good behaviour as an exile? If this had been the king's intention, then the plan failed. Bolingbroke took the opportunity of Richard's absence in Ireland to return to England in late June, ostensibly in pursuit of his Duchy of Lancaster inheritance, but in effect to mount a challenge to the throne. Richard was forced to come back to England, but before he did so, he ordered the young Henry to be imprisoned in Trim Castle, 30 miles to the northwest of Dublin. By the time Richard arrived home through Wales, Bolingbroke had taken control of much of eastern and central England. He managed by the 9th of August to reach Chester, previously a major centre of Richard's power. Richard had no choice but to agree to negotiations, which led to his surrender and being held prisoner. Around the 20th of August, Bolingbroke led him from Chester to London. By the end of September, Richard had been forced to abdicate and Bolingbroke had seized the throne. He had already ordered his eldest son to be brought back from Ireland. A shipmaster, Henry Dryhurst, was paid just over £13 for sailing from Chester to Dublin and back to collect him. The unusual circumstances of the usurpation and the change to the young Henry's fortunes as a result fascinated contemporary observers and triggered speculation on the conversations that might have taken place between himself and Richard in Ireland when the news of Bolingbroke's invasion broke. So a bit of a roller coaster for the young Henry then. He goes from being an extremely important member of the royal family to a completely disgraced one and disinherited one to now, well, a Prince of Wales in waiting, quite possibly a future king. So a real roller coaster there over just the course of like 2 years or less than 2 years. The English chronicler, Thomas Walsingham, who was alive at the time and saw and heard all these things himself, continuing the chronicling tradition of the Benedictine house of St. Albans, imagined Richard asking Henry, "Why has your father done this to me? I grieve for your person in that you will perhaps be deprived of your inheritance because of this unfortunate behaviour of your father." Henry's reply, though he was but a boy, was not childish. "Gracious King and Lord, I am truly much aggrieved at these rumours, but it is obvious to your lordship, in my estimation, that I am innocent of my father's actions." This pro-Lancastrian tale improved in the telling, serving to emphasise both Richard's deposition and Henry V's greatness as preordained. In both of the Latin lives of Henry V of the 1430s, Richard was made to foretell the future glory of Henry, as expressed in the Pseudo-Elmham. So these are supposed to be the words of Richard II. "We have heard that our own England is destined to give birth to a certain Prince Henry, who will be of exceptional grandeur in his deeds, of rare and immense military prowess, with outstanding titles of fame, and who will shine with prosperity throughout the whole world. We are of the infallible opinion that this very same Henry is that man. Anne Curry goes on. The 13-year-old Henry had played no active part in the deposition of Richard, but he was a beneficiary of it, and his life was irrevocably changed by it. He was probably among those knighted by his father on the eve of the coronation, which was the 12th of October 1399. He certainly carried the sword of justice at the ceremony itself, symbolising his significant place in the new dynasty. 2 days later, on the 15th of October, his creation as Prince of Wales, Duke of Cornwall and Earl of Chester was approved by the Lords and the Commons in Parliament, who also expressed their wish to accept him as rightful heir to the throne on his father's death. Henry IV, enthroned, placed a coronet on the head of Henry and placed a golden ring on his finger and put a golden staff in his hand and then kissed him. Henry, the Prince of Wales, was then led to the seat, ordained and assigned to him in Parliament by reason of the principality. Because of his father's need to secure his dynasty in the wake of a usurpation, Henry is the first eldest son of an English monarch known to have had a formal investiture as Prince of Wales in Parliament, and ended up holding a wider range of titles than any previous heir to the English throne. On the 23rd of October, he was made Duke of Aquitaine as a means of confirming the new dynasty's commitment to English interests in southwest France. On the 10th of November, he was also created Duke of Lancaster, his father having decided that as king, he could not hold this title himself, although he continued to retain direct control of the revenues of both duchies. So titles being heaped upon the young Henry now. Most of all, of course, the Prince of Wales, the heir to the throne, but a massive landholder besides that. So now, assuming his father can keep the throne, he has been the beneficiary of a massive promotion. The fates are smiling upon him at this point. The young Henry had been transformed from a landless and potentially defenceless prisoner in Ireland into a royal prince with substantial territorial interests. Yet just as he benefited from the trappings of royalty he had acquired, so he shared in the vulnerability of the new regime. The first anti-Lancastrian plot came only weeks later, which came on the 6th of January 1400, and the most high-profile victim was the prince himself, who, along with others in the royal household, allegedly showed signs of an attempt to poison them. The new regime's response was uncompromising. The leading nobles involved in the plot were put to death, and Richard II was murdered in the hope of curtailing any further threats. Again, a big moment to murder the king, the rightful anointed king, is massive. Whether he was, you know, whether violence was done to him, or whether he was just allowed to starve to death, we will probably never know. But it's a big stain on the new dynasty, one which Henry IV and Henry V, and going in generations further into the Wars of the Roses, can never really be wiped away. Before long, however, the king faced hostility from his erstwhile friends, Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland, and his son, Sir Henry Percy, known as Hotspur for his valour, who had been key supporters of his usurpation in 1399. Disappointed that the king had not rewarded them adequately during the first few years of his reign, they rebelled, bringing Henry IV to battle at Shrewsbury in July 1403. Although Hotspur and his uncle Thomas Percy were killed, the Earl of Northumberland was subsequently pardoned, only to stir up northern risings in 1405 and 1408. Both ended in defeat, for Percy that is, but these actions heightened Lancastrian fears. The 1405 rising prompted an excessive reaction of the king in ordering the execution of Archbishop Scrope of York for his support for the rebels. The rebellion of Owen Glendower in Wales, which began in the autumn of 1400 as a personal dispute with his neighbour, Reginald Grey, but which soon escalated into a campaign of Welsh independence, also became linked to a threat to the Lancastrian right to the throne. In 1403, there emerged a plan to divide the realm between Glendower, the Percys, and the young Edmund Mortimer, Earl of March, the descendant of the second son of Edward III. So there's another important thing to stress, that if the rightful king, the now killed rightful king, Richard II, was the son of the Black Prince, the son of the eldest son of Edward III, the rightful king, then if Richard II didn't have any children, which he didn't, then it should pass down then to the second son, the Black Prince's next brother, which was Lionel of Antwerp, the Duke of Clarence, and his children, who are the Earls of March. So Henry V, and his father Bolingbroke and his father John of Gaunt, they're not in line. It's the Earls of March that should be next. But they were just pushed aside. And the third son of Edward III, and his descendants take up the throne. Well, again, foreshadowing in the later episodes I'll do, obviously, all about the Wars of the Roses. This is the sticking point, or just rather, the House of Lancaster is just not the right family to have taken the throne. Okay. Anne Curry says, technically, this Mortimer line had a better claim to the throne than Henry IV, who was descended from the third son of Edward III. In time, Henry IV also began to suspect the loyalty of Edward, Duke of York, heir to the fourth son of Edward III. So Edward III definitely suffered from having too many ambitious sons. There were further anxieties for the new dynasty. Henry IV's usurpation undermined, although it did not break, the 1396 truce with France. The French, ruled by an increasingly ill king, were too divided among themselves to drive out the English from their French lands. But there was nonetheless major insecurity in the Channel for English shipping in the face of officially condoned French piracy, as well as an open war in Gascony, the last area held by the English in southwest France. A much more serious military problem was the insurgency in Wales, which dragged on for many years. This insecurity, both internal and external, brought with it financial difficulties. As a self-made usurping king, Henry IV's authority was weak in terms of persuading Parliament to agree taxation and in being able to choose how to spend his income. As I said in the last episode, if you remember, Henry IV, Henry Bolingbroke, had sort of endless problems with his Parliament and raising money and had to be subservient to them at least marginally, at least every now and again, sort of had to do what he was told by them in order to keep solvent. These uncertain, conflict-ridden years were also those of Prince Henry's royal apprenticeship. It was a time of almost constant military mobilisation, something which is especially significant given that Henry V would spend virtually his entire reign in active warfare. Indeed, he knew no other way to rule. Henry, Prince of Wales, had a longer military formation as heir to the throne than any monarch since Edward I. His knowledge of English military systems, his service in arms in Wales alongside several of those who were to accompany him to France later, and his appreciation of the importance of discipline, as well as of the tactical value of archers, all stemmed from the experience he gained during this period. In the early years of his father's reign, the prince's personality and outlook remained distinct, his actions informed by the circumstances of the new and fragile regime. His creation as Duke of Aquitaine in 1399 was made with a view to sending the teenage prince at the head of an army to this potentially problematic part of the English royal inheritance. But the Parliament of 1399 urged his father to reconsider, and they said, "The prince should not leave the realm at such a tender age until peace has been more securely established within the kingdom." Henry IV duly followed Parliament's advice. When, the following August, he invaded Scotland with a 13,000-strong army, Prince Henry received pay for a company of 17 men-at-arms and 99 archers, but again, probably stayed at home, having been appointed Keeper of the Realm in his father's absence. So he's still only something like 14 years old, and yet he's expected to hold the fort down while he's in for the whole of England, while his father goes off and fights in Scotland. So it's a bit of a baptism of fire. Once again, no real evidence that he's this flighty child who can't be controlled or trusted. Must have been quite a serious person, very young, to be trusted with that sort of thing, even nominally. Owen Glendower's Welsh Rebellion erupted in September 1400 as Henry IV was returning from his brief and inconclusive campaign in Scotland. The king duly headed for the Welsh border, where he was joined around the middle of the month by Prince Henry. On the 16th of September, perhaps deliberately choosing Prince Henry's birthday to make his announcement, Glendower had declared himself Prince of Wales. It was, therefore, essential that the real prince be present to put down the rebellion. Yet, as on subsequent occasions, for the sake of preservation of the dynasty, Henry IV did not take his son with him on his chevauchée, or raid, into Wales. Instead, the prince was sent to his earldom of Chester with power to pardon those Welsh rebels prepared to present themselves to him. Here he spent an extended period in the company of Sir Henry Percy, that is, the Hotspur, who was so trusted by Henry IV early in his reign that he was appointed Justiciar, or Chief Officer, of Chester in October 1399. The king clearly regarded him as a suitable military mentor for the prince. The latter was with Hotspur at the Siege of Conway in April 1401, after Welsh rebels had seized the town. In the following month, the prince continued his military tutelage at the siege with Sir Hugh de Spencer, a seasoned military campaigner and Lancastrian loyalist who had been appointed the prince's governor in October 1399. It took 6 weeks for Conway to surrender to the prince. his first exposure to the challenges of siege warfare, and not to be the last. In 1401 and 1402, still in his mid-teens, Prince Henry was again in North Wales. He was learning all the time, and it was here that he encountered the problems of dealing with guerrilla warfare in mountainous terrain. His baggage train was attacked by the Welsh, and his possessions carried off. Occasionally, his father counselled him in the practice of war, in one letter urging the prince to ensure the sound defence of the castle of Harlech, on the grounds that it cost less to defend places than to recover them, advice he would take to heart in his own conquest of Normandy, many years later, that is, obviously. At the age of 16, he was given his first formal command as royal deputy in Wales, with an army of 3,000 for the field as well as for garrisons. He tried to run to ground the would-be prince, but Glendower melted into the hills, and Henry contented himself with pillaging the pretender's lands. Writing to his father about this failure, the failure to actually capture Glendower outright, he expressed fears that his troops might desert. With cash running out, he had been forced to pawn his smaller jewels to pay them and to order his men to carry oats with them, since fodder was in such short supply within Wales. So bitter wars going on between the English and the Welsh in Wales, or on the borderlands of Wales at least. The prince was soon to learn an even harder lesson of the uncertainty of loyalties, one which surely remained with him all his life. When the Percys turned against the king in 1403, several of those who had been in the prince's intimate company in Chester and Wales now revealed themselves as enemies, bringing him and his father to battle in order to effect a regime change, maybe even to make Hotspur king. These included not only Hotspur himself, but his uncle Thomas Percy, who had been appointed the prince's governor at the death of De Spencer in late 1401, and who, in the words of one chronicler, slipped away from his prince's house in secret and with much of his treasure. So a real stab in the back there. In the following year, even the chamberlain of the prince's earldom of Chester defected to Glendower. The Battle of Shrewsbury on the 21st of July 1403 was a hard-won victory for the king's army and for the prince, who had been entrusted by his father with command of the vanguard, i.e. right at the very front of the battle. You're 16 years old now, boy. You can go and fight right at the very front in the most dangerous place and see blood and gore and slaughter and maybe get killed yourself. Off you go. You're old enough now. Edward III had given a similar command to his eldest son, the Black Prince, at the Battle of Crecy in 1346, when the latter was 16 years old. So, very interesting parallel there. For the two princes, this was a major military blooding, but it also served to encourage loyalty, confidence, and perseverance in the troops of the Royal Army. At Shrewsbury, both armies had large numbers of archers, using them to create an opening barrage to weaken their enemy's attack. While the larger royal army was able to predominate, the prince was wounded by an arrow in the face. He gained plaudits for his personal bravery, especially for encouraging his troops to fight on and for refusing to leave the field. We have a fascinating record of the medical procedure he subsequently underwent at Kenilworth Castle at the hands of his surgeon, John Bradmore, to remove the arrowhead, which had become lodged in the side of his face. Bradmore devised an instrument with a screw device that enabled him to grip the arrow and pull it free. The surgeon helpfully drew a sketch of his instrument, as well as describing the method used to cauterize the wound during and after treatment. Without Bradmore's intervention, blood poisoning could easily have ensued. It is likely that the wound left Henry with a scar, although this is never mentioned in any contemporary descriptions of him as prince or king. I mentioned last time, and it bears repeating really, that that must have been a pretty serious wound when an arrow goes bang right in your face and stuck in there and isn't pulled out for hours, possibly even days. And he's still running around fighting. But it's, you know, it's a trauma. It's a physical and you can only imagine psychological trauma. Some say that the famous portrait of Henry in profile is to hide the side of his face that was scarred. We're not sure if that's true, but could possibly be. It would have certainly left him with a scar. And he was just very, very lucky not to die of it in the first instance in and of itself, but also not to get an infection, septicemia. Very, very lucky. Of course, they had no concept of the germ theory of disease, no antibiotics. There would have been absolutely no way to combat it if it had gone gangrenous or something. So, yeah, just luck. And Carrie goes on. Perhaps because of his injury, Prince Henry spent most of his time in 1404 on the English side of the border, sending his senior captains on raids into Wales. These were not enough to prevent Glendower's power reaching its height in 1405. Aided by French troops, because of course, who marched with him as far as the prince's base at Worcester and also took the castle of Harlech, There, Glendower held a parliament in which, with considerable hubris, he announced his intention to broker a peace between England and France that would include an acknowledgement of Welsh independence. Such insults triggered Henry IV's plans for a big push by two 3,000-strong armies, one from Hereford under his own command, the other from Chester under Prince Harry. This initiative was thwarted by the need to respond to the rebellion of Archbishop Scrope, although the prince did not play a personal role in its suppression. In January 1406, the prince was appointed lieutenant for the whole of Wales, so something like a regent, or a viceroy, or a petty king even. The king had intended to remain involved himself, but the hostile activities of the French in the Channel forced him to return to London and to accept that the prince with his retinue and the power of adjacent counties, in whose loyalty the king places his trust, is in force enough to chastise and subdue the rebels of Wales, i.e. you're on your own, son, do the best you can, I've got my hands full elsewhere. At this point, the prince, that's our Henry, had 5,000 men under his command, with three archers for every man at arms, a contrast with the 1-to-1 ratio often found in the late 14th century for overseas expeditions. This 3-to-1 ratio dominated English military organisation until the 1440s, including all the expeditions and garrisons of Henry V's own reign. While it is tempting to believe that it was the prince's innovation, his father may have been behind it in reality. Despite the prince's central role in the conflict of these years, Henry IV was slow to give him independence before reaching his majority at 21. This was partly due to the prince's tender age, but it was too an effect of the Glendower Rebellion itself. So comprehensive was the uprising in Wales that by 1403, none of the prince's estate revenues in Wales or Flintshire could be collected because of the disruption. Funds from the Earldom of Chester had to be diverted to cover the costs of the Welsh castles still under English control. As a result, the prince faced a large financial deficit, which inevitably impacted on his ability to act independently. His father's involvement is also seen in the choice of officials. Tried and trusted Duchy of Lancaster men were placed in key posts across the prince's lands. The king had an influence over the grants of annuities too. Such a situation was to be expected while the prince was underage, but as he approached his majority, he would wish to exploit his own patronage and to build up his own affinity, his own royal household that is, completely independent of the king. He began to do this from October 1407. 51 new grants of annuities were made in the course of the following year, a marked contrast with an average of 10 per annum over the previous 6 years. By this point, Henry IV's health had been in noticeable decline for 18 months. The exact nature of his illness remains uncertain, but it involved a degenerative skin condition as well as debilitating attacks, perhaps in the form of strokes or epileptic fits. So if you remember last time, Churchill said it was heart attacks. We just don't know. The detail isn't there, and their medical knowledge wouldn't have been up to it anyway. Anne Curry says this, the symptoms would fit with a diagnosis of tertiary syphilis, creating a protracted decline over around 8 years, but interspersed with more severe bouts, which undermined his capacity to give full attention to government. As the king's health deteriorated, the moment of the prince's succession loomed ever larger. He might become king at any point. As in similar situations across history, the effects on both father and son were marked. In 1406, Henry IV experienced major criticisms from Parliament, whose records suggest hopes for a better future were already focused on Prince Henry. Early that April, the Speaker, on the Commons' behalf, petitioned the king to send a letter of thanks to his son for his constant commitment to winning back Wales, quote, and for the chastisement and punishment of the rebels there. And in the same address, he urged that the prince should reside continually in Wales for the wars. 2 months later, with Henry IV present in Parliament, the Speaker took the opportunity of making another eulogy on the prince. God had bestowed and endowed him with a good heart and as much courage as any worldly prince could need, he stated, adding that God had given him one great virtue. In particular, he listened to his advisers. No wonder Parliament played up that was a virtue, listening to your advisers. Indeed, such was the prince's trust in them that he was genuinely and graciously willing to be contradicted and to conform to the wishes of his council and their ordinance in accordance with whatever seemed best to them, setting aside entirely his own will. Not only did the prince listen, but advice could be plainly given without fear of censure. What was more, the prince had no ego. He was quite happy to change his view if, in the opinion of his advisers, that view was wrong. the implication to the listening Henry IV was obvious. Praise for the prince's willingness to take counsel was a way of criticising his father for failing to do so. The commons, it was clear, were already looking forward to the day he might be king. So Henry IV a bit unpopular towards the end, and certainly the antagonisms between crown and parliament were kind of never ending. The prince himself faced a dilemma. While the commons were adamant that he should return to Wales with all possible haste, from his perspective, it was preferable to stay in London in case his father died. Even though the dynastic threats had subsided, it was wise to be close at hand to prevent any disruption to his possible accession. Perhaps, too, he was concerned about an act passed by Parliament that June, which stipulated that on Henry IV's death, the crown should pass to Henry and then to his male heirs. But if he had no male heirs, then the successor should be his brother, Thomas, the Duke of Clarence. This may have made him less keen to expose himself to danger in Wales, especially when his father was ill. There were signs already that Thomas was his father's favourite, and that relations between Henry and his eldest youngest brother were lukewarm. Whether or not Prince Henry ended up going to Wales is unclear. His movements at this time and over the following years remain difficult to trace, but in October 1406, perhaps at his instigation, the laws of succession were changed. Now the crown should pass to Henry, and then to any heirs of Henry's body, not simply males. The odds of his brother Thomas succeeding to the throne had, in theory, substantially lengthened, or he'd become less likely, which was presumably exactly what Henry had in mind. And he was definitely present at a contentious royal council meeting on the 8th of December that year, in which a wide-ranging discussion, both of the king's itinerary, which the council took the liberty of dictating, at least in part, and of royal government was held. The meeting resulted in 31 articles being put forward in Parliament that month for governmental reform, which included a request that all items and matters passed by the council should be passed by all those of the council in person. The emphasis was clearly on consultation and collective responsibility. But we can see there that our young Henry is doing the job of government in all sorts of ways. He's extremely important, perhaps the most important voice in government below the king, and is even beginning to claw power away from the king himself, at least a little bit. And now, not that his father, Henry IV, was a tyrant or anything, but he's not going to like that. No monarch likes conceding power. So Anne Curry goes on and tells us that Prince Henry's regular inclusion in the Royal Council for the first time was a sign not only of his growing political importance, especially in the context of his father's deteriorating health, but also of efforts to bring men of higher status into government. The Commons of 1406 had shown disquiet at Henry IV's tendency to use more lowly knights and esquires, and at his spending so much on patronage of those within his circle. By involvement in the council and in response to the Commons' requests for reform, the prince was also indicating his support for efforts to cut costs and end corruption and favouritism. Therefore, as Henry IV's reign progressed, the prince became increasingly critical in public of his father's rule and increasingly impatient to assume the throne himself. So there's going to be tension there between father and son. No avoiding it. Absolutely no avoiding it, if that's how each of them are playing their given hands. The following year, however, the prince was briefly in Wales for the siege of Aberystwyth, which he intended to conduct in such a way that it would be seen as a major symbol of English recovery. But his handling of it proved a disaster. While Henry IV had been harsh in his treatment of the Welsh, his son wanted to be seen as merciful. Therefore, he offered a treaty of composition. If Glendower did not come to rescue the town and give battle, then the defenders would surrender without the need to give hostages. The prince had relics brought to the siege by his friends, the cleric Richard Courtenay, for the mutual oath-taking. Henry's clemency turned out to be completely misguided. With no royal army encamped around Aberystwyth, Glendower entered the town and expelled those who had made the agreement. Aberystwyth was not taken by the English until September 1408, and by others, not the prince. Although the prince continued to hold the royal lieutenancy in Wales into 1410, he chose not to play a direct role, basing himself in Worcester and Hereford when not in London. Anticipating that he might become king any day, he therefore needed to be close to the centre of government. Apparently, it did seem that the old king was close to death for years. They expected he might die at any day, any moment, for years, which, of course, it goes without saying, is far from ideal if you want a clean succession. Other matters were occupying him now. At the end of 1407, the French, beset by deepening internal divisions following the assassination of Louis, Duke of Orléans, at the behest of John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, don't worry, I'll go into all those details in the next episode, were keen to reopen negotiations with the English, including the prospect of marriage for the prince. So if you think England is in a bit of a desperate state of flux, the French are in full-blown civil war. Although nothing came of this, it was increasingly apparent that, with the French king suffering from mental illness, factional infighting in France would continue. The assassination of Duke Louis, the king's brother, had given the Burgundians the upper hand at this stage. So there's two big factions in France, the Burgundians and the Orleanists. The English, including the prince, watched the situation with interest, i.e. waiting for a particularly weak moment in order to pounce. Prince Henry attended the royal council often throughout 1408 and carried considerable influence within it. His lack of affection for his brother Thomas is surely reflected in the council's decision in August that the latter should no longer be a charge on the king's household, while a year later, Thomas was replaced as lieutenant in Ireland by the steward of the prince's household, Sir John Stanley. The growing influence of Prince Henry on royal policy and his interest in military provision are also revealed by his appointment as Constable of Dover and Warden of the Cinque-Ports on the 28th of February, 1409. Around the same time, he was given custody of Edmund Mortimer, Earl of March, and his brother, as well as the keeping of their estates since they were both minors. With Henry IV increasingly concerned that he might not have much longer to live, he drew up his will on the 21st of January 1409, it was sensible for his heir to have control of a possible rival claimant to the throne. Remember, the Earls of March are descended from Lionel of Antwerp, i.e. they're the ones that really should be on the throne, if we go by the letter of the law. But the scions of that family are only little children, so they can just be kept under control for now. That autumn, Prince Henry spent much time with the king at his manor of Burt Hampstead, expecting his father's end to be imminent. The prince was increasingly frustrated. His father's ill health had left the crown at an impasse. He had appeared to be on the verge of death for a number of years, and things came to a head in December when the prince took matters into his own hands and began to chair the council in his father's absence. There were major disputes between the prince and the old guard over what should be given priority. He forced his father's councillors to resign, the treasurer, Sir John Tiptoft, and the Chancellor, Archbishop Arundel, the latter being a particularly close associate of the king and opposed to the reforms and changes which the prince supported, and introduced his own nominees to office, Henry, Lord Scrope, as treasurer, and Sir Thomas Beaufort as chancellor. He had the parliament intended to meet at Bristol switched to Westminster. In this parliament, which began on the 27th of January 1410, fully one-sixth of its members were connected to the prince, i.e. his men, his quislings. It was opened by his half-uncle and ally, Henry Beaufort, Bishop of Winchester, brother of the Chancellor. Throughout this parliament, the prince's reformist agenda shines through. The articles presented by the Commons on the 23rd of April 1410 included matters close to his heart, such as the costs of the household, enforcement of legislation and law and order. During this parliament, a restriction was also placed on the king's authority. That's a big one. Although its precise nature is uncertain, it hardly endeared young Henry's takeover to the sick king, and nor, we can imagine, did the prince's cutting of expenses of the household and suspension of some annuities. So even though, as we just told there, the exact details are not really known to us, there was some sort of power struggle going on now. It's not just the young Prince Henry nipping at the heels of his father, or, you know, suggesting that maybe we should take away some of his powers or think about what's best to do. He's actually doing it. He's actually beginning to do it, beginning to usurp his authority. Well, even though Bolingbroke is extremely ill, he isn't dead yet, and there's still a bit of life left in the old man, and he doesn't take kindly to such things. In this reformist atmosphere, it cannot be a coincidence that a bill for disendowment of the church was put forward at the Parliament by Lollard sympathisers, knights and esquires who followed the teachings of John Wycliffe. I've talked about the Lollards and Wycliffe before, haven't I? Hopefully you remember. They're sort of proto-Protestants in a way. With an emphasis on Bible-centred fundamentalism, they, the Lollards, challenged the church's teachings on the sacraments as well as the special authority of the clergy and papacy. They believed that the church had been corrupted by its involvement in secular affairs and by its extensive land holdings. Hence, they sought in the petition of 1410 to redistribute its possessions in order to fund more worthy causes, such as almshouses, the defence of the realm, and even an expansion in the number of lords, knights, and esquires. Henry had friends who were sympathetic to new ideas in religion and they were emboldened by his dominance of the government and by a belief that he was open-minded enough to allow at least debate. Nothing came of the petition, but Henry had not shown himself as hostile to its sympathisers. That will change. When John Badby was condemned as a heretic by the Bishop of Worcester for denying transubstantiation, that the bread and wine actually did turn to the body and blood of Christ in the sacrament of communion, and was handed over for burning in March 1410, the prince had attended in person and made every effort to persuade Badby to repent, even halting the burning briefly when he believed he heard Badby wishing to do so. Throughout 1410 and for most of the following year, the prince's dominance continued unchallenged. He brought into the council more of his own associates, including the Earls of Arundel and Warwick, and Henry Chichely, Bishop of St David's, while council meetings were held in unorthodox venues, such as friends' houses and the prince's own dwelling at Cold Harbour. Dispensing with the usual protocols, Prince Henry was visibly distancing himself from his father. An expectation that it would not be too long before he became king is reflected in the presentation of the prince. The prince's ascendancy is evidenced in foreign policy too. In July 1410, the council agreed that financial priorities should be given to the prince for the defence of Calais, then under threat of French attack. Having already argued for the importance of this isolated English outpost in France at the Council of December 1409, the prince had himself made captain of Calais on the 18th of March 1410 and had ensured that 75% of the wall subsidy granted at the Parliament should be earmarked for the wages of the garrison. In France, however, divisions were worsening between John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, then in control of the royal government in the light of the French king's incapacity, and his Orleanist enemies. Charles, Duke of Orleans, the son of that Louis who was assassinated by John the Fearless, had built up a group of supporters. These became known as the Armagnacs through Duke Charles's marriage to the daughter of the Count of Armagnac and included several leading peers. So continuous civil war in France, basically. Certainly large-scale factional fighting, you can say, at the very, very least. By 1410, the situation was sliding into civil war. In August 1411, Duke John approached the English for an alliance. By way of marriage between my lord, the prince, and the eldest daughter of the duke, a reiteration of the proposal of 1407, but this time in return for military support against his enemies. Prince Henry was not slow to spot an opportunity, specifically gaining Burgundian support for the recovery of English lands in France. The central tenet of English policy towards France remained an insistence on the terms which Edward III had negotiated in 1360 at the Treaty of Brittany, often known to the English as the Great Peace, with good reason. Remember I said in one of the earlier episodes that this Treaty of Brittany was extremely advantageous to the English, crazily advantageous to the English. So we would always hark back to it, even though it's like 50 years ago now. We would still keep saying, we want the terms of that. We insist on those terms. And the French nearly always saying, no way. I mean, the terms from the French point of view are sort of crazy. So it becomes a sticking point, even though it's 50 years ago. Anne Curry says, this treaty had given English kings a substantial swathe of sovereign territory in southwest France. But from the end of the 1360s onwards, with Edward III no longer the force he had once been, and then under the boy king Richard II, most of these territorial gains had been lost. Now, in 1411, the deal with Prince Henry, struck with Duke John, reflected his lack of experience in foreign affairs. It was vague and open-ended, requiring no firm guarantee of Burgundian help for the recovery of the lands of the Treaty of Brittany. Yet Henry was committed to the treaty, presumably because he saw it as a way of dissuading Duke John from attacking Calais. That October, the prince sent English troops under the prince's close friend, Thomas FitzAlan, Earl of Arundel, to help the Burgundians recover Saint-Cloud near Paris, which they did on the 9th of November. Tellingly, these troops were not funded from the royal exchequer, but from the prince's own revenues in his earldom of Chester, an indication that the ailing king had not been in agreement with his son's plans. Increasing concerns about young Henry's actions, as well as an apparent involvement in his health, led to the king planning to take back control of government. So finally, Henry IV seems to have had enough how much power Prince Henry was taking for himself, without even asking, really. But tensions escalated. The prince tried and failed in September 1411 to protect Richard Courtenay in his role as Chancellor of Oxford against the visitation rights of Archbishop Arundel, which threatened the independence of the university as well as the authority of its chancellor. In the following month, six of the prince's household knights, including his steward, Sir Roger Lech, were arrested. Around the opening of Parliament on the 3rd of November 1411, the prince appears to have confronted his father, saying that he should abdicate as he could no longer work for the honour and unity of the kingdom. That's quite a thing to say, isn't it? You're no longer up to being king, old man. Move aside. A proposal seems to have been put to the lords by the prince and Henry Beaufort, quote, as to which of them should ask the king if he was prepared to resign the crown of England and allow his firstborn son to be crowned, end quote. So now there's open talk of abdication. It's a power struggle now, you know, a completely bloodless one and relatively low energy one, but nonetheless, a power struggle for the very, very top job. Rejecting these approaches, the king took swift action. On the 30th of November, the prince and the royal council he had assembled were publicly sacked in Parliament. The speech the prince gave in response reminded the king waspishly, quote, that they would have been able to do their duty better had they been given more funds and support. The prince was openly criticising the king and the old guard for their opposition to his reforms and his foreign policy. On the 19th of December, the last day of the Parliament, the king squashed the restriction which had been placed on his royal prerogative in the previous Parliament. The prince's associates, Henry, Lord Scrope and Thomas Beaufort, were dismissed from their posts as Treasurer and Chancellor, respectively, on the following day. Sir John Pelham, a long-standing member of the King's Duchy of Lancaster staff and Treasurer of the War in 1404 to 1406, was appointed Treasurer, and on the 5th of January 1412, Archbishop Arundel was reappointed as Chancellor. The new council contained none of the prince's associates. So young Prince Henry is out and the old king is back in control for the time being. Curry says, the prince was cast into the political wilderness. Relations with his father worsened in the spring of 1412 when the king responded positively to an approach by the Armagnac faction in France for military support against the Burgundians, so the other side in the French Civil Wars. In the subsequent treaty, signed at Bruges on the 18th of May, the Armagnacs acknowledged all English rights of the Great Peace, that's the Treaty of Brittany, and furthermore offered to assist Henry IV in his just quarrels with the King of France in return for military support, an army of 4,000 men, and a promise not to enter into any alliance with the Duke of Burgundy. Yet in practice, the king showed himself as naive as the prince had been in 1411. The Armagnacs were not in control of Charles VI, and could not turn their promises into reality. Furthermore, by the time the English troops arrived in France on the 10th of August, the Armagnacs and Burgundians were already negotiating a peace with each other, which was finally sealed at Auxerre on the 22nd of August, 1412. So the English efforts to play the French factions off against one another had come to nothing, basically. The French had made up among themselves, to all intents and purposes, again, at least for the moment. But one thing to mention there, which I feel I should stress, is you might have noticed that the armies involved here are all quite small. You know, an army of 4,000 men there, an army of 3,000 men here and there, and even a big army is 13,000 men. That's a massive army at this point in the early 15th century. Why? Well, because of the Black Death, because the entire world's population had plummeted. And so in generations before this, you'd have much, much bigger armies, vastly bigger armies. But now, a third, maybe a half, maybe two thirds of the entire population of Europe was gone. And so, of course, the size of armies reflect that as well. So, yeah, a contingent of 3,000 or 4,000 men is quite something. It's not to be sniffed at. 10,000 or 15,000 men is big. You know, 20,000 or 30,000 men is gigantic at this stage. Almost unheard of, really, in this stage. So that's why the numbers of armies, are, you might have noticed, are so small. Okay, we'll let Curry continue here. She says, quote, Henry IV had hoped to lead the army to France himself, but by the 8th of June, illness forced his delegating of command to his second son, Thomas, whom he created Duke of Clarence on the 9th of July. So the army sent over to France, this 4,000 men that the English had promised to the Armagnacs, is being led not by what you would think would be the first choice, i.e. Henry, our Henry V to be, but his next brother down, Thomas. He gets the glory, except there wasn't any glory to be had. Curry goes on saying, Prince Henry's relations with his brother had now reached a very low ebb. While in control of the council in June 1410, he had already refused to pay Thomas the arrears due to him as Lieutenant of Ireland until he demonstrated that he had fulfilled the terms of his contract. the implication being that his brother's word could not be trusted. Now he was completely outraged by the preference being shown by his father to Thomas, whose position had also been strengthened by his marriage in November 1411 to Margaret Holland, widow of the king's half-brother, John Beaufort, Earl of Somerset, and niece of Archbishop Arundel. In addition, Prince Henry was embarrassed by having to write to the Duke of Burgundy in late May to explain that he had had no choice but to accept his father's decision to support the Armagnacs. Very embarrassing politically, isn't it? That you've promised all sorts of things and then you have to say, oh, sorry, my dad says I can't. Sorry, I can't play out. My parents have forbid it. On the 17th of June, a week or so after Henry IV had publicly delegated command of the army to his second son, the prince issued a public letter from his manor of Chalesmore in Coventry. He had been willing to go on the campaign, he claimed, but his father had suggested that he go with such a small force, quote, that the king had made it impossible for us to serve him with honour or to make effective provision for the proper safety of our person, quote. The king, Prince Henry insinuated, had deliberately engineered Thomas's command of the army. Moreover, he added, quote, certain sons of iniquity, quote, had sown rumours that he was trying to disrupt the expedition. These people, he claimed, were desiring, quote, to attack the proper order of succession, quote. The implication being that they were planning to set him aside in preference for his brother Thomas. Prince Henry took care to name no names, but reading between the lines, it is clear that rumours were rife that he was planning a coup against his father. Around the end of June, the prince came to London with considerable company of friends and a large retinue of men in his service, such had not been seen before in those days. A reminder, if indeed anybody now needed reminding, of the fact that he had a large affinity of armed men at his disposal. So the old king had wrestled control back, but the Prince of Wales, our Henry, just had lots and lots of badass knights at his command who were loyal to him personally by this point. So he rides on London. It could all get very nasty very quickly here if people aren't careful. Could get real dark real quick. But Curry tells us, the king delayed admitting him to his presence, but finally did so, according to Thomas Walsingham, welcoming him with open arms. The first English life of King Henry V gives a colourful account of this meeting. Although written in 1513, a century after the event, it may have some basis in reality, since the anonymous author had at his disposal reminiscences of the 4th Earl of Ormond, who had known Henry V. Here the prince comes to the king wearing a blue robe full of eyelet holes, each with a needle hanging from it. The meaning of such a garment is unknown. Perhaps the holes and needles were intended to symbolise that the prince was not a finished product. The prince fell to his knees and offered a dagger with which the king might kill him. And he's supposed to have said, my life is not so desirous to me that I should live one day that I should be to your displeasure. Even so, the king gave an obtuse answer to the prince's request that those who had denounced him should be punished if they could not be found guilty, saying that such a procedure should await the next meeting of Parliament, so that men such as these might be punished after judgment by their peers. The king, clearly, did not see the need for action as urgently as Prince Henry did. It took him the best part of 6 months to issue summons for a parliament to meet on the 3rd of February, 1413. So even though the young Prince Henry had ridden on London, it was to show his loyalty to his father. Whether all of that is fun and games, whether all of that is some sort of PR stunt, whether the accounts come down to us are truthful, it's not entirely clear. And the king himself seems to have wanted to punish his son for doing that, but he didn't punish him quickly or severely or anything at all. So a bit of a weird episode there, a bit of a weird set of events. It's hard to tell exactly what was going on, you know, behind the scenes. You can sort of read between the lines a bit, can't you? But there's still a power struggle going on of some type or other, but it's certainly bloodless. Okay, continuing on. Meanwhile, the council had taken the opportunity to investigate other charges against the prince that had been involved in peculation, embezzling the wages of the Calais garrison. This inquiry took 3 months, from July to September, and the prince was not fully exonerated until the 21st of October. So allegations of stealing money, but he was found not guilty of anything. He tried to put pressure on the king again in September by coming to London with a large retinue. So he sort of pulled the same trick again. There may even have been an assassination attempt against him at this point, or so it was claimed in 1426. But amid the rumours of plot and counterplot, the king's state of health continued to decline. The opening of Parliament planned for the 3rd of February was postponed. On the 20th of March, Henry IV finally passed away, dying in the Jerusalem chamber in the abbot's lodging at Westminster Abbey. So it seems a bit of a deliverance that the old King Henry IV finally died because, you know, again, reading between the lines, it seems like the power struggle was becoming more and more dangerous, or neither side were prepared to sort of give in. And although it had been bloodless, would it have stayed that way? Would the factions have started fighting each other, even if the king or the Prince of Wales hadn't actually tried to kill one another? Would their men have started fighting? Would there have been a real political break? Who knows? But kind of thankfully, in a way, the old king dies of natural causes, finally. I mean, he's not even that old. He's only in his late 40s, but as we've kept saying, he's been ill for a while now, so there's no shock. Continuing on, because nothing stops, life must go on, we're told, to what extent father and son were ever fully reconciled during Henry IV's lifetime is difficult to assess. A deathbed scene is found in so many narratives that it cannot be dismissed as simply invention, although it was coloured by how Henry V chose to transform himself after his accession. Both of the Latin Lives of Henry V describe the dying king giving his blessing to his son before telling us of acts of contrition by the prince, lamenting his past bad behaviour. The First English Life also gives an extended scene around Henry IV's deathbed in which the king expresses his concern that, after his passing, discord would arise between the prince and his brother Thomas. The prince assures him otherwise, and in a long oration, his father gives him his blessing. Stories of a deathbed reunion also spread abroad. Burgundian chronicles, written in the mid-15th century, claim that Henry had been seen by his dying father trying on the crown. That's very presumptuous, isn't it, if true? But that this led to an act of contrition by the prince and the forgiveness of his father. Closer to the event, we have a letter to his son supposedly written by Henry IV on his deathbed and recited in a work attributed to Thomas Elham. This was very much in the mode of a model for princes, urging the prince to honour God and protect his people. By the early 16th century, stories of the prince's ill-spent youth were popular and were subsequently taken up by Shakespeare. In reality, there is no evidence from the period itself that the prince behaved as Hal did. That's sort of the character, Good King Hal, in the play, Shakespeare's play, Henry V. So Anne Curry says there's no evidence that he behaved that way. Stories of his criminal tendencies and his arrest by Chief Justice Gascoigne were 16th century inventions, although he did indeed remove Gascoigne from office on his accession. But the two Latin Lives say intriguing things about Prince Henry. The pseudo-Elham, for instance, speaks of the prince as, quote, an assiduous pursuer of fun, devoted to organ instruments, an intentional double entendre, which relaxed the rein on his modesty, although under the military service of Mars, he seethed youthfully with the flames of Venus too, and tended to be open to other novelties as befitted the age of his untamed youth. Since these sit awkwardly in what are otherwise sycophantic texts, and both works have links with men who knew Henry well, we should give them some credence. There are other signs of the prince's enthusiasm for novelty. He owned the earliest known manuscript of Chaucer's Troilus and Cressida, acquired sometime between 1406 and 1413. His keenness for works in English is also seen in his commissioning of John Lydgate in October 1412 to write the Troy Book, although the poem was not completed until 1420, and of the dedication to him, when prince, of a translation into English of Gaston Phoebus's Livre de Chasse by his cousin Edward, Duke of York. The latter work remained important to him, since he commissioned 12 copies of it as gifts in November 1421. His youthful energy, which no doubt contributed to his sense of frustration in waiting for his sickly father to die, is also suggested in the Latin Lives, which speak of him as having a long neck and a graceful and strong but not muscular body, with an excellent turn of speed when running to catch deer. Although we have evidence of expenditure on a hastilitude of peace, which was a form of tournament, at his manor of Kennington at Christmas, 1409, there is no evidence that he ever participated in person in a joust. As king, his associates seem to have been keen to send wrestlers to entertain him, perhaps reflecting his enthusiasm for the sport. What cannot be doubted is that Prince Henry was impatient to become king. The way he conducted affairs when in control of the government in 1410 to 1411 suggests that he did not always conform to expected patterns of political behaviour. Witness his convening of the Royal Council in private houses and the suspicion that he had misused funds for the Calais garrison. Relations with his father reached crisis point at the end of 1411 when he tried to force an abdication and again in the summer of 1412, when he was believed to be attempting a coup, and when his father may have considered excluding him from the succession, and may never have been fully resolved in Henry IV's lifetime. This situation led to the prince's disengagement with government in the last year or so of the reign. Such knowns can be taken to suggest that the unknowns of riotous behaviour and unsuitable associations are true. End quote. Okay, so that's the end of the portion of Henry's early life. He's now become king. Your king, immediately upon the death of the old king, having a coronation is basically just sort of rubber stamping it. The moment the old king has ceased to live, you are immediately king. So our Henry of Monmouth is now King Henry V, and events only speed up. There's very little hesitation from Henry once he becomes king to start acting and doing big things politically and militarily. He hits the ground running. He's roaring to go. So next time I'll talk all about the actual reign of Henry V. And it's, again, a great roller coaster of events. It's certainly not boring. So I hope you've enjoyed this so far. I hope I've done it some justice. I hope it's sort of worthy of episode 200. As always, let me know in the comments any thoughts and feelings you've got. Okay, so until next time, take care.